The Texas Panhandle is fortunate to be home to an amazing natural phenomenon, Palladura Canyon. It's the second longest canyon in the U.S., and with depths of up to 800 feet below the rim, it provides a genuine Southwest experience that no other place for miles can offer. With approximately 30 miles of trails and nearly 150 campsites, it has endless outdoor opportunities for those wanting to spend the night down below or at home or hotel. From hikers and runners to cyclists and equestrians, Palladura Canyon is a year-round mecca for outdoorsy people, photographers, and those just wanting to soak up nature's finest. Oh, and it's also a major component of our local tourism, but more on that later. Roll the intro.
You're listening to Buff Speak, the official podcast of the Paul and Virginia Engler College of Business at West Texas A&M University. I am Dr. Nick Gerlich, your host, as we meet up with the thought leaders making an impact today.
My guests today are Zach McMeans, Assistant Superintendent at Palladura Canyon State Park, and Kevin Lane, a frequent volunteer there who makes plenty of things happen. Guys, thanks for being here, representing my favorite state park. Introduce yourselves.
Yeah, Nick, thank you so much for having us. My name is Zach McMeans. Like you mentioned, I'm the Assistant Superintendent at Palladura Canyon State Park. Have been in that role for about a year and a half. I'm a 2017 graduate of West Texas A&M University with a degree in agricultural media and communications. West Texas boy, born and raised, grew up in a small town called Gale, about an hour south of Lubbock. There are 15 people in my graduating class, and I'm a triplet. So we made up a fifth of our senior class, and that's what led me to WT. My sisters went to Texas Tech, and I wanted to get away from them. So have loved being in the Panhandle, worked at West Texas A&M after graduating for about 5 years in student affairs, overseeing student conduct and behavioral intervention, and then moving over to the Paul Engler College of Agriculture and Natural Sciences. Worked at Palladura Canyon when I was in college as a seasonal maintenance ranger, and then following my time at the university, went and joined a company called Cintas Corporation and worked there for 4 years, most recently as a manager of one of their Fort Worth locations. And then the opportunity opened up for me to come back to the Panhandle and back to Palladura. And so it's certainly been a fast and furious year and a half, but it has been the most rewarding professional experience that I've had.
And so is this the extent of your time then with Texas Parks and Wildlife?
It is, except for, about a 5 month period when I was in college as a summer seasonal ranger. That's my time, year and a half.
All right. And how about you, Kevin?
Yeah. Thanks so much for having us. It's great to be here today. My name's Kevin Lane. I'm a volunteer here at Palladura Canyon State Park. This is about my fourth year at Palladura. I actually live in Seattle, but I have deep ties to this area. My father was born in Turkey. My mother was born in Kittiquay. So I've been coming down here for a long time. One of the people the other day asked me the first time I saw Texas, and I said it was in 1965, but don't do the math. So I live in Seattle. I went to college at Oklahoma State University. I got a degree in biochemistry. I then moved to Seattle and finished medical school at University of Washington in Seattle, practiced for a number of years before I got out of medicine and went and worked at Microsoft for about 16 years before I finally retired and then embraced the job I love now, my retirement job, which is a volunteer interpretive ranger. And so it's like I tell people, it's good I did this last, because if I'd done it first, I'd be really happy but not very wealthy.
And you also volunteer at some other parks as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So I kind of make the rounds. I always pick it so that I'm at Palladura when it's nice and cool and the snakes are all sleeping. And so I work at Petrified Forest National Park. I've worked at Olympic and Mount Rainier National Park in Washington. I work at a Bureau of Land Management site on the Oregon coast doing marine mammals and whales and seals. And so it's a little different from Palladura. And I've worked at the Dunes National Recreation Area in Oregon as well. So I kind of pick my places based on climate.
You get to maximize your fun then, right?
I get to maximize my fun. But one of the real challenges is every time I leave a park, it's sad. It's like leaving part of my family because they are part of my family. And I love each one of these parks. People ask, what's your favorite? I don't really have a favorite. They're all my favorites.
And so you get to know all these people for however long you're there, and then you're off to the next one. But then you come back next year, hopefully, right?
Exactly. Yeah, it's like a family reunion every year.
Great. Hey, if you guys had to give a one-minute elevator speech on Palladura Canyon to some total stranger who had never heard of it, never been to the Texas Panhandle, what would you say?
One way to say it is kind of the way some of our European visitors say it. They go, flat, flat, flat canyon. Big canyon. Beautiful place. Amazing place. Amazing hiking. Friendly people. It's just a place that has to be seen to be believed.
Absolutely. I tell people all the time, Paladera Canyon is the story of Texas. We have everything from rich natural resources all the way to the depth of the history we have. Over 12,000 years, people groups have called Paladera Canyon home. And one of the biggest things that we get with our visitors is, you know, tribal history and Native American history. And we were the site of the last real battle of the Red River War. And so talking about how that has just shaped America as we know it today, the resources that we're entrusted with protecting, and then the most beautiful views you'll get in the Panhandle. And you can only find it in one place, and that's Paladera Canyon.
What's the history of the state park itself, and when did it open?
So it's a really interesting history. It was really established in 1933, but people were talking about it as early as 1906. People had discovered this, wanted to make this into a national park. There were a lot of efforts that went into place, but the park officially opened July 4th, 1934. At that time, there were only about 120 acres in the park when it first started opening. And the CCC went in and built that road and built everything going down. And over time, more ground and more land has been accumulated. CCC actually left the park in December of 1937.
Wow. So they did all that work. They cut that road using very crude machinery, right?
It was all by hand.
Oh, by hand.
By hand. Oh. And so they were using hand tools. They had some machinery, but they had an option. They could either buy more machinery or hire more men. It was the Depression. They really wanted to hire people, and so they just hired men. So they moved that rock on that road by hand, and where the visitor center is. A lot of people don't know this, but that visitor center, originally the land it's sitting on was up on the rim. National Park Service didn't want a building obscuring the rim, so they blasted out rock there and moved it by hand and built the visitor center, the Coronado Visitor Center, on that little slope they created.
So it's kind of terraced in that area. That's
exactly.
Interesting. I had no idea about that. Huh. What else can you add to this story, Zach? Anything?
Yeah, when the National Park Service, or excuse me, the CCC was first looking at this land, there was actually another state park that was in development here in the Panhandle. It's now where Starlight Canyon Bed and Breakfast is. It was called Palisades State Park, and they still have some CCC structures there on the grounds. And so while we are all familiar with Paladero, and we're certainly thankful that Paladero has lasted to 90 years as a state park, there was a lot more effort being done to create more state parks in the Panhandle. And then through budget cuts and monetary concerns, those started falling by the wayside. But there are still remnants. And if you haven't been to Starlight Canyon Bed and Breakfast, I recommend you go. Their Grand Lodge is a CCC building, and it's beautiful.
I caught a glimpse of an old road map about a week ago, and it was from the 30s. Didn't have a date on it, but I could tell by some of the route markings and so forth, I could kind of get a good idea. Paladera Canyon was not on that map, but another place called Wayside State Park was on there. I'd never heard of Wayside State Park. Kevin, you have any idea what that's all about?
There was a lot of scrambling back in the 30s to try to obtain land for the park. A lot of the land wasn't owned by the state at that point. They'd actually raised some money to do it because there were hopes to make that a big national park all the way down. One of the challenges is at that same time, there was another state park that was kind of being considered. It's called our national park. It's called Big Bend. And one of the challenges for Paladero was the land at Big Bend was only about a penny an acre. The land at Paladero was $10 to $20 an acre. So that was a big, big impediment to that. And so one of the things that they did was they were looking at different places they could have excursions. One of the big things that happened were auto excursions out to the canyon early on to get support for building the park. And that wayside could have been one of those excursion routes.
Now, I've seen a lot of photos from way back that predate when it was actually a state park, which basically means people have been going out there for a long time. They may have had to just kind of, you know, trespass or renegade a little bit to get out there to see some of these things. But it's been an attraction here for as long as there have been people in the settlers in the panhandle. Let's just say that. We'll get to the Native Americans later, I guess, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the big people that came out before it was a state park was this artist that you might be familiar with called Georgia O'Keeffe. When she was teaching here at WT, which was West Texas Normal College at that point. And so she spent some quality time out on Goodnight Peak and on the plateau below the visitor center there. It's where she started her abstractism career.
And what do you guys know about the Native Americans who lived here? Zach, you said 12,000 years. That's a long time of inhabitation in this canyon. Who were these people?
Started off the Clovis people group. And then that just progressed on and on. And the final tribal group that you had that called the canyon home, it was really made up of three tribes. And that was the Kiowa, the Comanche, and then the Southern Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes. So they were living here all together. And to this day, there's still deep friendships that remains with those tribes. Last year in September, on the date of the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Palo Duro, we had the honor of bringing in all three tribes for the first time since the battle. And so getting to hear some of their elders just share stories and talk about how there are now family relationships between these tribes that are spanning into the fifth, sixth, seventh generation and still going strong, those relationships start in the canyon. And you've talked about the draw for people. We know it's been a sacred place for centuries, if not thousands and thousands of years. So those are the last tribal groups that called it home. They still come down to the canyon quite often. The Cheyenne are still very involved. As this is such a sacred ground for them. There's also stories. I've got to do a little bit more research, but we have a neighboring landowner that I was having coffee with the other day. And he said back in the 60s, he and his dad were going through a little shallow canyon or shallow cave in their canyon, rather. And they started digging it out. They were doing horseback rides. So they wanted a place where they could stop and water the horses in the summer, let people get out and explore the canyon. And as they were digging it out, they came to a man-made wall. And they called West Texas A&M, and they got the archaeology department that we had at the time out here, and they started excavating that wall, and behind that, they found a burial ground. It was for Pueblo Indians. And so Kevin may be able to share a little bit more to that, but one of the fascinating things is they had the chief wearing the bird bone breastplate. They found shells from the Oregon coast that were inlaid with turquoise from New Mexico. And so this is far earlier than anything we've really known about as far as tribal groups coming into the park. So we're starting to do a little bit more research on this locally and seeing how we can add to the story that is Palo Duro Canyon.
And that's great because that Petrified Forest National Park was that transit route over to the coast. And so we see a lot of the Pueblan culture there. We see a lot of trade goods there that don't belong there that we know came from here, such as Alabates Flint or other things through. So our grasp of what really was going on back then is just having the surface scratched right now.
Well, the first Europeans to come through here were through about 1541, a fellow named Coronado. What do you know about him and his group? I mean, I can only imagine. I've read that it was a very, very large entourage, and I hate that the thought of them having to all line up at the gate and wait to pay for a pass. You know, that would have been a major mess right there, trying to get 1,500 people processed and into the park. I kid, of course. But still, what do you know about Coronado's time here?
So they were looking for the cities of gold. They'd come from eastern New Mexico. They'd heard about these cities of gold. They started traveling across La Llano Escondido, which was the Staked Plains. And the story is they put stakes out because if they didn't, they might end up going in a circle with this large entourage. So they kept looking for water, looking for water. Huge entourage, priests, wagons, everything. They were running short of water. They actually found Palo Duro Canyon, came down, saw the Prairie Dog Town branch of the Red River, and gave thanks because there was water. So actually the first Thanksgiving was not on that East Coast thing. It was here in Palo Duro Canyon.
That's pretty cool. I mean, to think about Coronado coming all the way through here. He wandered around quite a bit of this area, though. He made it up to Kansas, right? Mm-hmm. And then I've seen things in his honor over in New Mexico, too. I guess that was on the return trip, I guess. But they never found what they were looking for, did they?
No. Well, we have a different goal today. It's the canyon, right? He was looking for monetary, and we think we've got scenic gold now.
Well, there we go. And what about the canyon? How old is it?
So if you look at the rock in the canyon, and this is a little deceptive, some of that rock in the canyon and the stone, that deep red layer you see down at the bottom, 240, 250 million years old. And so very, very old stone. You'll see that white lines in that stone. That's gypsum because this was all ocean. This was all salt water. So we see a lot of marine fossils as well. But for the canyon itself, that canyon really started to be created around a million years ago when we started having that erosion to start exposing all of those layers. So when the Rocky Mountain uplift happened, the Rocky Mountains were raised up through tectonic activity. Moved this way, pushed a lot of material this way 60 to 80 million years ago. That was kind of the beginning of the canyon, but it really didn't form completely until just about a million years ago. If you go down to Caprock Canyon State Park, that's the oldest part of the canyon. You can look and see it's wider and shallower because we get downwashing of material. And that makes that canyon wider every time it rains and a little shallower.
You mentioned rain. We've had a lot of it this summer and in copious amounts. It never drizzled. It either flooded or it didn't rain. And since I'm a frequent offender, or repeat offender, I guess, of the canyon, I notice how much erosion has happened just this year. Some of the trails have like foot deep gullies running through the middle of them that didn't exist before. And we've lost, footbridges, and I've noticed changes on the CCC trail where there's a couple of places now where you kind of have to watch your step or else you're going to go flying downhill.
We erode about 6 inches of soil per year. And one thing that really brought home to me how fast this erodes is the lighthouse formation and some of those colorful formations that you see in the canyon, the yellows, the maroons, the purples. It's really, really soft stone. On top of that stone is really, really hard stone, sandstone. And so it's supported. So if you see hoodoos where it looks like a little toadstool with a rock on top, it's where that soft stone is eroded away and exposed and left that hard stone on top. Like I said, lighthouse is made of that same material. First year I was here, I walked out on that Triassic trail going out to Goodnight Peak. There was a solid, hard stone ledge that went right out over to the edge. Looked out, went over that edge. It was really pretty. Came back the next year, third of that was gone. It had collapsed underneath. Next year, another third was gone. Finally, that third year, it had completely collapsed down. And people will walk out there thinking it's solid and find out, yeah, it's not so solid underneath that. So the erosion in a geologic time frame happens incredibly fast here.
Is that leading up to what used to be the Sad Monkey?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. I've been there. There's a pretty good gap there now.
Exactly.
I wouldn't attempt it.
Mm-hmm. When I got to Petrified Forest, they said, oh, we erode about a quarter to a half an inch a year. And I just laughed at them and said, yeah, you've got nothing on us.
How many different geologic eras does this span?
So you've got three eras total, from Paleozoic to Mesozoic to Cenozoic. So those three epochs are all in there, and you've got different layers within those. So you've got that Permian, Upper Permian, which is that low stuff, the oldest stuff in the park. Then we go up to the Triassic time period, and that's where we've got most of our fossils from, Triassic period. And then we go up to the Pliocene time frame. So we've got Triassic, but we're missing the Jurassic layer, which everybody knows, and we're missing the Cretaceous layer, which everybody knows as well, as far as the death of the dinosaurs. So unfortunately, we can't be called a Jurassic Park.
Mm-hmm. And why are we missing those?
Great question. If somebody figures it out, we'd love to know. So it could be erosion. It could be they were smashed by that hard, tough layer on top, which is mostly clay and caliche, really heavy Oogalala layer. It's really, really heavy stuff. That's what gives the cap, as you say, in cap rock. And so it might have been smashed. It might have gone away. This was all deposited by ocean. This is all sedimentary rock that was formed as oceans went in and came out and laid material down. The interesting thing is this is all an unconformity in the geologic and the fossil record. You see this unconformity go all the way across to Petrified Forest National Park. We have the same problem there. We just have Triassic, but nothing else.
And it's not that we didn't have dinosaurs, at least nearby, because I know there are dinosaur footprints in northwest Oklahoma near Black Mesa. And, of course, down near Granbury at another state park, they've got some really famous dinosaur tracks in, what is that, the Paluxy River?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you think about it, this all happened, and they were around before this canyon started forming. And so, and before that Rocky Mountain uplift, these dinosaurs were roaming around doing their thing. So that could have been washed away with the uplift. It could have been washed away as erosion.
So basically, our park is just a big geology laboratory.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And because we got the cliff walls, we get to see all these eras all together.
You get to see all the fun stuff there at once. And actually, some of that fossil record you get to see as well. It pops up every now and then after we have a big rain. And it actually is so close to what we saw at Petrified that Paladuro Canyon State Park had given this artifact to Panhandle Plains Museum. They shared it with Petrified Forest National Park to do a cast of so they could have a dinosaur sculpture of the same dinosaur.
I think it's mind-boggling that what we see now is the tiny prairie dog town fork of the Red River did all this. I mean, that's just crazy because there's not that much water flowing through it. And actually, for about a month late summer this year, there wasn't any water flowing through it at all. And I know why, because we all know the source of the water today compared to what it was then. But was this little creek always this small?
Oh, no. This was a huge creek. There was lots and lots of water. And if you were down in the park when we had heavy rain sometime this summer, you got a little preview of what it might have looked like back then. Raging water flowing down, tearing, eroding away. And so before water flood control and dams went in, very, very rapid flow down through there. That's one of the reasons the Comanches and the Arapahoes and the Kiowas were here, because we had lots of water here in the bottom of the canyon that created the canyon. We had lots of prairie grass because we had fires every year that would burn the mesquites and the junipers down, fertilize the prairie grass. Wherever you've got lots of prairie grass, you have tens of thousands of bison. And wherever you've got bison, you're going to have the native people that are going to be following them for food.
And did they ever grow crops down in the canyon?
Not necessarily. They might have been hunter-gatherers. We see mortar holes. So we see holes in stone down in the canyon where they might have smashed juniper berries and other things. But they weren't agrarian. They weren't like some of the Pueblan tribes necessarily. They were really following the food. And one of the interesting things was when the Comanches finally got horses and domesticated horses and started hunting, they went to almost a pure protein diet. They were early paleo people to the point where they actually got protein poisoning because they were having birth defects. They were having miscarriages. They couldn't figure out what was going on. They were clever enough to figure out, wait a minute, we're just eating protein all the time and no vegetables, nothing else. And so they actually started trading with other tribes for those foods.
Well, what kind of fossils can you find down in the canyon?
Oh, that's a great question. So we actually find some marine fossils because this was all ocean. And as the water slowly retreated from here in the Permian Basin before the uplift, fossils were left all throughout here of those marine bivalves, etc. One of the big things we find a lot of is phytosaurs. So picture about a 25 to 35 foot crocodile with a really, really long snout, with teeth about 2.5 to 3 inches long. That was kind of the apex predator. So we find a lot of those here. We also find what's called a metoposaur, which is actually a kind of a cross between a salamander and an alligator, 10 to 15 feet long, would lay in the water, murky water, as an ambush predator, had a lateral line system. It could sense when creatures were coming around it because it was murky, and it would just close its mouth and eat them. So we had those fossils. But then if we jump up to the Pliocene era, that was the Ice Age. That's where we jump above the Jurassic and Cretaceous. Mastodons, woolly mammoths, saber-toothed cats, camels in Paladuro Canyon, believe it or not. We actually had an ancestor of the coyote, which was a bone-crunching coyote. So if you thought coyotes were bad, bone-crunching is worse. And some of the original horses.
Zach, do you think the state park would have ever happened were it not for the CCC programs in the 30s?
You know, I don't know that it would look like it does today. There's always been interest since the early 1900s in getting a state park in the canyon. But when you look at getting Paladuro to look like what it does today, the road that goes through the bottom, that wouldn't have been able to happen without the CCC program. And the amount of labor that it took to get it to where it's accessible. And to me, that's my favorite part about Paladura Canyon. Unlike the Grand Canyon or many other canyons that are parks throughout the U.S., you can't get to the bottom of this. So Kevin's talking about the geology, and that's what brings it to life. As you're driving down that road, winding into the bottom, you're looking out. My favorite thing to do is see visitors pull off to the side of the road and just stop and glare mm-hmm. and take pictures. But no, the CCC is really what made it possible for this to be a state park. And they took so many dreams and made them a reality. I do think you would have seen state parks in the Panhandle, like Palisades State Park. But Paladura would not exist as a state park without the CCC.
And the Triple C workers that were sent here were incredibly diverse. There were just young men who needed a job. There were veterans, and there was even an African-American group that was sent here. So we had a lot of people from different walks of life, different backgrounds and so forth, all pitching in to make this thing happen. That was pretty incredible here. It's easy to think that the park is finished, but in the 36 years that I've been living here, I've seen it go from having only one paved water crossing, the one with the marker sitting above it that shows where the historic flood was, to all of them being improved. It didn't happen overnight. I think they did them like one at a time as money became available. But it's been so long now that I don't think many people remember it without crossings. I mean, literally, they were a low water crossing. You splashed. And sometimes you didn't go through them because it didn't take much to fill them up. So basically, in other words, there have been ongoing improvements made, new trails. Like I said, I've been here long enough. I remember when the mountain bike trail system was built. I remember, Lower Comanche, may have been Upper Comanche too. Both of those are relatively new trails. What kinds of things do you see coming in the future?
So I'll start off by saying I think the best days for state parks are ahead of us. The state of Texas and Texas voters have really taken substantial steps in saying we support our state parks and we want them to be funded. So we saw the Proposition, I believe 5, get passed that set aside $1 billion to be dedicated for land acquisition for state parks. We've also seen the sporting goods sales tax be passed. So now 93% rather of every dollar that is spent on sales tax for a sporting good goes to state parks for us to be able to revamp our parks. Being a CCC park, we are in desperate need of repair. And that's one of the things that we're focused on now. But looking forward, we're working on what's called the public use plan, or the PUP is what we call it. And it's the first time Paladura has had an in-depth one of these since, I would say, the 90s. And what this does, it allows regional staff, the park and park staff, and the state to come together and say, what do we want Paladura Canyon to look like 10, 15, even 50 to 100 years from now? And make sure that we're intentional about the plans that we're putting in place. So with that being said, I can't get too in-depth. We've had about 3 or 4 meetings so far. But I will tell you that it is exciting. We're looking at allowing access to parts of the park that are currently not accessible. We're looking at adding new trails through the bottom, as well as more trails that'll go up through the top of the canyon. We're also looking at expanding opportunity for more camping areas, for more lease concession air spaces, and trying to bring in a more diverse offering for our guests. And there will be a time where the public is able to add public comment for this. And so I'm eager for us to get to that point. We're still a few years away, but it'll be a great opportunity for our visitors to say, have you thought about this? This is a need. I've been coming here for 50 years, and this is something I've always wanted to see done. And we'll put this together, and it'll allow us to have a robust plan that moves the needle on upgrading the park, on increasing our offerings, and really transforming the visitor experience. And what the public's going to see first is the new headquarters building. We're getting ready here in about 2 years to start construction on that project. It's going to drastically change the visitor experience. Right now, we're operating out of a CCC gatehouse. It was never designed to be the hub for Paladura Canyon, but that's what it's become. And we're so limited in what we have as far as traffic lanes. We have 2 lines set up. And so, Nick, you said you go out there quite a bit in the summer. I'm sure you've waited in line for 30, 45 minutes, maybe even an hour. What this is going to do with this new headquarters building is give us 5 lanes to be able to get the public in quicker. It'll also give us a transformative space inside that's going to provide top-notch interpretive space. It's going to allow people to come in and gather, get their questions answered instead of being confined and trapped in a little 800-square-foot gatehouse. And what that's going to do to the current gatehouse is make that into, right now, it's looking like a museum. So if you ever look on an aerial view of that area where the exit road is, it's going right through the middle of what was originally a courtyard. So we're looking forward to restoring that just as it was when the CCC put that in, and having another outdoor space, day-use space on the top of the park. So again, while this is a lengthy process, we are really making some positive traction. And here within the next year to 2 years, the public can expect to see some construction going on for the new gatehouse.
That's great. And another thing that's not going to happen is development along one of the rims. And this is recent news, right?
Correct.
That was one of the ranches there cooperated with others and basically deeded the land such that it can never be developed.
We're so thankful for that. You know, Kevin mentioned about how the CCC moved the Coronado Lodge down from the rim because they didn't want it to distract. If you look at the three rim cabins that we have up top, they're all built below eye level. As there has been more development, there is certainly an impact to the landscape and the horizon of the park that is disrupting the views of the rim, especially on the Sunday Canyon side. And so what this is going to do, this easement that was made between the Rim Ranch and the Texas Department of Agriculture, is that section of the rim that goes from behind Mac Dick Pavilion, past Sagebrush, towards Hackberry Campground, is going to be preserved in perpetuity. And so we're thrilled for that, that visitors, no matter 10 years from now or 50 years from now or 150 years from now, are going to be able to have a place where they can go and see pristine canyon land as it was created. And so we're certainly honored that the family chose to make that choice.
Zach, you got to tell me about volunteers. Volunteers like Kevin, what types of volunteers do you need and how many?
Well, let me say, Paladura Canyon State Park would not exist as it does today without the volunteers that we have. And Kevin is a shining example of the selflessness that they have. And see, we don't pay you, so I've got to give you a few compliments.
Just give me a raise.
Okay, I'll add another zero to that figure. But no, we need a variety of volunteers. So first and foremost, I want to mention the Partners in Paladura Canyon Foundation. This is a nonprofit that really makes it possible for us to function. They run the visitor center, which is in Coronado Lodge. The profit that they make off selling their product goes directly into the park. And so, letting you in on a little secret, we operate with a shoestring budget. We bring in, you know, $2.5 to $3 million a year in revenue. Out of that, we get to keep about $350,000. So by the time we get done paying our Excel bill, our electric bill, a third of our budget is gone. So when we're looking at trying to upkeep 30,000 acres, over 50 miles of trail, 4 camping loops, it's impossible to do with the budget that we have. And so Partners is really the backbone behind the park. They make sure we have the rescue equipment that we need. They've bought lawnmowers and weed eater strings, anything we need to the sheets in the cabins and the towels that go into the rim cabins, they purchase. And so they're certainly an invaluable partner group. The next group I'd like to mention is our trail team. So on any given day, we only have 4 full-time maintenance rangers in the park. And when you're considering this idea of being a CCC park, we have the Coronado Lodge, we have the gatehouse, we have three rim cabins, and we have 4 cow camp cabins. So we've got 9-10 historic buildings that certainly require a lot of repair. This summer, as you mentioned, we saw a lot of rain. My goodness, we could not stay on top of the mowing. Those guys did a phenomenal job. But the point I'm trying to make is, there's enough on their plate in day-to-day operations that they don't have time to take care of the trails as they should. And so the trail team has been an incredible group. Over 40 years, we've had the trail team in some form or fashion working in Paladura Canyon State Park. But I'll tell you what gives me pause is this group now is all in their 60s, 70s, and even a gentleman that is in his 80s. And so we realize that we're operating on borrowed time. And unfortunately, we've tried to do some trail days. This last Sunday, for example, we're always getting people commenting online, oh, we'd love to help, we'd love to volunteer. So you try to create an opportunity, no one showed up. And so as far as our trail team volunteers, there's certainly a need in order for us to be able to add more trail, in order for for us to maintain what we have, that's certainly a very immediate area where we need volunteers. We also have Park Host. Kevin is an interpretive host, so he gets to help our park interpreter with interpretive programming. They get to double the offerings while he's here of what we're able to offer instead of just one park interpreter. They do a great job with school groups and going out to local school districts and doing presentations. But in addition to the interpretive host, every Camp Loop has a Park Host site. So that's somebody who takes care of greeting our visitors when they come in, helping answer basic questions, cleaning the restrooms, and freeing up our staff's time as well. And then the last group, we just have a Master Naturalist and another group affiliated with Partners in Paladura Canyon that maintain the wildlife viewing area. So it's a diverse operation. We have a lot of things going on, but we are incredibly thankful for the volunteers that we do have, and certainly encourage anyone that's interested in volunteering to reach out to the park, and we'd love to get you plugged in.
Well, I can especially be thankful for the trail team because that's what I use all the time. And I know there were lots of times this summer when I was disappointed that the trails were closed because it had rained and washed out footbridges and basically was waiting for volunteer labor to come restore those footbridges, which I guess were just what washed away downstream, but may have had to be rebuilt on occasion.
And Partners is the one that provides our funding for that as well, the Partners in Paladura Canyon Foundation. The problem is with those bridges, and people get so upset because it looks dry. Why are the trails not open? We've got to bring UTVs back there with winches. Those bridges are so heavy. And so in honor of keeping the integrity of the trail system in place, it's going to have to be dry before the volunteer group is able to get back there on the UTVs. But no, this summer absolutely wreaked havoc on those bridges, as well as the trails in general. And those guys, for a group of volunteers, thank goodness they're all retired because it was a full-time job keeping the trails in pristine condition this summer.
And I know in particular one trail, Cottonwood Trail, where the Johnson grass was probably 12 feet high. Had you guys not, or those guys, been able to get down there and get that mowed down, they would have had to reroute the Paladura Trail Run because they use a portion of that trail. That was a jungle.
It was a literal jungle. It was. It is in such a low-lying area. And then you have the idea of soil compaction. So any of these trails are just pressed on and pressed on and pressed on so much that they're not porous. Water can't get through and drain through. So the water just sits on them. On Cottonwood, you have a lot of tree coverage. And as you mentioned, the Johnson grass, the sun just couldn't get through to dry it up. And so they were incredible down there with weed eaters going in grass that was twice the height of them, just trying to get sunshine on it to dry it up. And it was out of commission all summer. But thanks to their work, we were able to put it back in rotation for the PDC 50.
So, Kevin, you do a lot of interpretive work here, but tell us what that means.
So interpretive work is a whole range of things. It's really making sure that the park visitors have a great experience and they want to protect the park and they want to come back and have a good time. That's everything from leading hikes to doing programs on the history, the geology, et cetera, to meeting with school groups, getting them introduced to the canyon. So many of our school groups, the kids have never been here before. From Amarillo, it's so sad. It's such a great resource. And so the idea is get them to come to the canyon, come to the park, see what it's like, get their parents to come, get their parents engaged. But that interpretive is really just sharing the resource with everyone and not telling them the whole story, but giving them enough to get them interested that they want to go find out for themselves.
What kinds of wildlife can you see in the canyon today? I mean, you told us about what was here millennia ago. What can I see today?
So one of the questions we get all the time is, are there bison here? And we go, well, you have to go a little further south for that. And so the bison at Cap Rock are actually the descendants of the bison that were here that Marianne or Molly Goodnight saved. What you're going to see down there mostly is going to be white-tailed deer, mule deer, tons of coyotes, lots of coyotes out. We have bobcats here as well. We do have an occasional mountain lion that makes a transit through. We see footprints, we see scat occasionally. All the way down to porcupines. I often tell kids when we're hiking, go look up in the cottonwood trees by the river. If you see what looks like a furry nest that's up in the tree and it's breathing, that's going to be a porcupine up in the tree. We do see signs of beaver activity here. We haven't seen beavers, but we see signs of activity. Tons of raccoons. If you're ever around one of our dumpsters, you'll find that out right away. We do have striped skunks here. And then one of our big finds from last year was a ringtail cat. So we were doing a wildlife survey at night and turned the spotlight on and saw this ringtail cat. all the staff were amazed. They'd not seen one live before. And so we watched it, got a great video of it, posted it on Facebook. And we were actually getting calls from Europe and an interview from a German radio station that wanted to hear all about the ringtail cat. So tons of wildlife down there, lots going on. We do have snakes, and so we always caution you to look out when you're walking around. We have bats, and the bats were still in the park last week when I walked around. The Mexican free-tail bats were under Bridge 1. So it's a very, very diverse landscape. Lots of animals down there, lots of wildlife. Your best chances are going to be early in the morning or in the evening. In the middle of the day, they figured out it's time for a siesta. Take it easy.
Yeah, I'm familiar with those snakes. It was May a year ago. I was pounding it out on the GSL, and I walked right across one. I guess in my mind, I'm thinking, oh, it's a tree root. I'll just step over it. And as I was stepping over it, it moved a little, and I jumped 10 feet in the air and screamed like a girl, you know. And then I turned around. It's like, oh, my God, I almost stepped on a rattlesnake. But even though it was warm, it was May, the snake was basically still just sunning itself and wasn't the least bit interested in me, didn't coil up, didn't rattle. He just was just spread out and let me walk right over it. Hallelujah.
They don't want to do anything more with you than you want to do with them. And so that said, right now they're very active. They're all getting ready for winter. So they're all fattening up. And so we just say, be cautious when you're out walking. They blend in really well. Don't reach up to rocks that you can't see over the top of. Bad idea. But they're out there. We also have other non-venomous snakes that are out as well. Long-nose snakes, hog-nose snakes, king snakes. They all contribute to that ecosystem. They take care of our rodents. It's all a balance.
You have wild boars too, don't you?
We have feral hogs. The park, unfortunately.
I've seen them.
You can see evidence of those feral hogs. Prickly pear, they love. If you see prickly pear and there's a big trench dug up beside it, they're going after the roots there. You'll see them down in the Johnson grass where they've flattened it down, where they've spent the night down in the valley between the roads. And so they spend time out there. We don't see them often during the daytime. At night, I just caution people, be aware that they're out there. Look for them. They blend in really well. We don't have javelinas up here as far as we know. I have seen them down at Caprock Canyon, and that's part of the same canyon system, so they could be migrating. So
you got some loose cattle, too. I've seen them many times. In fact, on the Palidoro Trail Run, I was on Lower Comanche, and I heard cows mooing at daybreak, and I thought, they're out. They're back. And where they come from, I don't know. Down past the equestrian area, maybe.
Bordered by a lot of properties, and occasionally they get out, and there's a lot of wild canyon out there still, right? The park's very big, a lot of areas that the cattle can get into that most people don't go to. And so they can be all over the canyon there. I was hiking Cottonwood the other day with the American Sign Language group, and I saw a paddy on the side of the road, and I thought on the side of the trail, and I thought the horses have been down here. And I looked again, and I went, nah, it's not horses.
And what about the odd dad sheep?
Oh, yes, we have lots of odd dad sheep. And so that's a great example of what happens when you introduce an animal that's not native to a region into a region. So back in the 50s, these were all Barbary goats that were imported from northern Africa for hunting up on the rim ranches. Some of them got out and they did what animals will do. And now we have way too many odd dad sheep. Their only natural predation is really mountain lions here. But if you look at the horns, those horns protect the neck really, really well. That's where the mountain lions want to go. The mountain lions have also figured out deer are a whole lot easier to go after than odd dad sheep. So the odd dads kind of have the run of the place here. And so we watch out for them. They're very fast. They're very nimble. But we have way too many. So when we have our annual hunt, that's one of the things that we hope some of that population gets reduced. This happened up in Seattle as well in Olympic National Park. Somebody thought it would be great to have mountain goats in Olympic National Park, which were not native. They brought a bunch in. Those goats got aggressive and they actually killed a hiker up there. And so they decided we have to get rid of these goats. So they went out and tranquilized them all. And then they had to airlift them out because Olympic National Park is very big and very remote. So you might be hiking out on a trail and you'd hear a helicopter and you'd look up and hanging underneath, flying through the air, is a sleeping mountain goat. It was a very surrealistic summer that year.
And the odd dad are competing with the native deer for the same food.
Exactly. And you'll see herds, up, especially up on Sunday Canyon and then that little draw of 40 to 80 odd ads running around.
Every city and region hopes to become a tourist destination, and Paladura Canyon has become just that for Canyon and Amarillo. It is a significant tourism driver, from casual day users to multi-day campers and those participating in special events. That's up after the break.
Life sometimes has a way of interfering with our university education. Marriage, family, work, any or all of these can cause us to hit the pause button on our degree, with hopes of one day finishing it. The only problem is that returning to campus can get a lot harder when you're no longer 20 years old. And that's precisely why we launched our online BBA, with majors in accounting, finance, general business, marketing, management, human resource management, and computer information systems. Available completely online. You can return to school without having to step foot on campus, or maybe you want to transfer in from a two-year program elsewhere, but once again, are not able to attend face-to-face. Our online offerings are for you as well. We can help you finish your degree and climb higher on your career ladder, at your pace and in your time. We're AACSB accredited and among the most elite of business schools around the world. Reach for the stars and do it with a WTBBA in hand. For more info, find us at wtnu.edu/COB or call 806-651-2525.
More times than not, when I go to the canyon, and I go about 75 times a year, I have to wait in a long line to get in. This tells me that the park is bringing in some serious numbers. And I bet that while there are likely a lot of locals visiting, the majority are from out of town. It is these people who make an economic impact, spending money on gas, food, and lodging. Zach, how many people do you know visit the park each year?
So this last year, fiscal year for us runs September 1st through August 31st, we saw just over 353,000 visitors come through the park. And again, that's not including some of our special event numbers, like the 2,000 to 3,000 that can come in with 24 hours in the canyon, or the 700 to 1,000 total with runners and volunteers with the Paladura Trail Run. So that's down a little bit this last year from the year before. We had 380,000 visitors that came through the park, and our highest visitation was in FY21 when we saw over 463,000 visitors, and that was thanks in a large part to COVID. But speaking of the economic impact, we're currently statewide focusing on revamping and reassessing the economic impacts we have in our local communities. That's been through a series of surveys that have gone on for the last year. Ask people from questions from, how much money did you spend in the community? Are you spending the night in a hotel room? How much money did you spend dining? How much money did you spend in the community buying equipment for this trip? And so we're looking forward to those numbers coming out. The last numbers that we had come from 2018, a study that Texas A&M University did, and it said that we had a $5.7 million economic value add for Canyon and Amarillo, created 124 jobs and generated over $320,000 in sales tax. And I think about what's changed since then. One, we've seen our visitation numbers increase, but we've had additions like the Sad Monkey Mercantile right there just outside of the canyon by about a mile, half mile. There's been an increase in canyon or in rims cabins that are owned and operated privately for people to go out, like Dove's Rest, and there's been several other cabins that have popped up along the rim. So we're certainly eager to get those numbers back and be able to put a dollar sign on the value add that Paladura Canyon brings to the community that we love so much.
And how much entry fee revenue do you take in each year?
Last year, we brought in $2.8 million in camping and entry fee revenue, and that's a pretty accurate snapshot. On average, we're between $2.5 to that $2.8 million.
Why do you think the numbers have gone down since COVID?
I think that's a great question, and I think it's twofold. One, return to work. During COVID, people had the freedom to work from home or work remote jobs, so it was easy to load up, get in a camper for a weekend, and go to Paladura Canyon State Park or any one of the state parks. State parks around the nation saw an increase in visitation during COVID. So I think that was one of the reasons. Two, Texas is adding new state parks. And as people got to spend more time in their communities and go to neighboring state parks, they realized what hidden gems they had locally. So I think we've seen this year will be another record year for visitation in Texas state parks. So that tells me that more people now than ever before are going to state parks here in the great state of Texas. So I think that's a big part as people were able to go to places like Palo Canyon, fall in love with the outdoors, get experience camping and hiking, and now are doing that in their own neighborhoods instead of making the 4-hour drive up here.
I think it's astounding that Palo Duro can attract so many people for being in such a remote part of the state. I mean, for example, parks near the DFW, Metroplex, Austin, San Antonio, et cetera, well, they got the advantage of a huge population base nearby, but we don't. The panhandle is scarcely more than 400,000 people. That's less than Plano and Frisco combined, you know, so we're a lot smaller than those areas, and yet we still pull them in. Basically, what this means is people have to travel quite a distance to get here, and they seem to be pretty willing to do so. What is the ultimate draw that gets them to come here?
It's twofold. One, we are in a wonderful geographic location. A lot of visitors that we interact with are making Palo Duro a stop on their way to Rocky Mountain National Park or going up to visit the Five in Utah or the Grand Canyon. And so they're planning their trips around Palo Duro, knowing that they've got a great place to stop, stretch the legs, get some hikes in, or maybe get camping over the weekend. But I think the most important draw to Palo Duro Canyon is it is one of the last places that you can get to that's remote. And so people from DFW, and that's where we see the number one in terms of zip codes from Texas and visitors is the DFW Metroplex. And when we visit with those guests, they talk about the stars. They talk about how when they go to state parks that are in the DFW Metroplex, there's sounds of semi-trucks going by. And so sure, you're going to get some great views, but you're not secluded. You're not remote. You don't get that isolated feeling. And so Palo Duro is one of those last places. Instead of driving all the way to Big Bend Ranch State Park or Big Bend National Park, which takes a lot more time on the road and is certainly a lot more remote, they have the amenities of Canyon and Amarillo, great dining and shopping, but they can go back to the canyon and unplug and get away from everything. And so I think that's why Palo Duro will maintain being one of the top three state parks in the state of Texas in terms of visitation. And thankfully, with the easement you spoke about and several other easements in place, we're trying our best to protect that sense of remoteness, isolation, and the view that you get at night with those beautiful stars.
What's the seasonality of tourists like? Personally, I like the fall and winter the best, especially the winter because it's not hot. I mean, it may be 50 degrees up here. It's going to be close to 60 down there. The snakes aren't out. There's no bugs. I got the trails to myself. I'm not swatting. I'm not sweating. I'm in heaven. But what is it like for the overall flow of tourists? Is it steady or does it have peaks and valleys?
You know, we used to joke that there was an off season. And what we found over the last couple of years is there's truly not. The months of February and January, we will see a little bit of a dip. But from March through really October, we are full on tourist season. So that's families coming out, taking vacations, making their trips out here, and the park is jam-packed every day and every weekend. Really from November and December through the rest of the winter, it's more families. It's more retired couples that are coming out and fleeing the snow up north, trying to come down. We're still booked every weekend. And so still, if you're not booking 5 months out in advance, you're going to have a hard time finding a spot to camp. And that has not always been the case. So I think as more people are finding out about Palo Duro Canyon, that's only going to increase. So it's a year-round operation.
Let's talk about some of the special attractions that Palo Duro either once had or still has. There's one of them in my list here that you still have, but others that have gone by the wayside, like the Sad Monkey Railroad, the chairlift, horseback riding. I've ridden a horse down there. It was before, long before the pavilion was built. That's where the stables were. And then they moved the stables to where the railroad was. But now none of them are there. The only thing that's still there is Texas, the musical. So what's the role of all of these, and why don't we have those other three?
So one of the really big reasons here is a reason that you see across the country with a lot of high-risk things. Insurance costs get very significant, and so it becomes problematic for a business to remain profitable when they're paying higher insurance premiums for higher-risk items. Certainly that applied to an extent to the railroad, to the chairlift, and to horseback riding. It's very expensive insurance. The second thing is, back in the 70s and up to the 90s, that was kind of an attraction to pull people in. They were having problems that we don't have today with attracting people to the canyon. And so in the 90s, people looked at that and said, some of the leadership said, you know, this kind of detracts a little bit from the natural beauty of the park. This isn't really what we're about. And so maybe we should look at something just taking this out and having the park stand on its own merits, which seems to have worked really well. You can still see remnants of those, right? The Sad Monkey Railroad bed is there. And then at the GSL trail, you can still see the cement pad off to the side where the chairlift was and the gap in the rocks. So they were really cool things. It was kind of fun to see that. I don't know if their era is completely past or not, but for now, we just don't have those.
Mm-hmm. With so many miles of trails, you would think that most people would be content to stick to them. Yet I know that folks do wander off. I've seen people in some interesting places that I wouldn't go. I even witnessed a helicopter rescue a few weeks ago. Someone was up on Fortress Cliff and was having some issues up there. It was still pretty hot. Is this even allowed?
It's highly discouraged for hikers to go off trail. And really, it's discouraged, Nick, for three reasons. One, as you mentioned, there is a danger in going off trail. Rescues that take place for off-trail rescue situations last hours, up to 8, 9, even up to 13 and 14 hours. And wow. One thing that I want to stress is when rescues happen, not only does it tie up our park staff, it ties up Canyon Fire, Randall Fire, and BSA paramedics. In fact, there have been many times that we've had both of the two county ambulances in the park. So what does that mean for our neighbors that call Canyon and Amarillo home? And I'd like to mention the majority of park staff calls Canyon and Amarillo home. It means delayed responses to any calls for service that come in to Canyon Fire, Randall Fire, and BSA. So one reason is it's our attempt to be good neighbors and make sure that we're not tying up these resources from our neighbors in the community that need them. The second goes back to our root mission as Texas Parks and Wildlife. The mission of Texas Parks and Wildlife starts off, and our mission is to manage and conserve the natural and cultural resources of Texas. Kevin's talked at length about the valuable natural resources that we have in the park. And so when people are going off trail, they're bushwhacking in areas they shouldn't be, they're stepping on sensitive vegetation, and I think worst of all, they're creating social trails, which goes back to the safety issue. We've had a number of rescues where people said, well, this looked like a trail, but it's a result of people going off trail trying to find some of those resources you were talking about, Nick, and creating an area where people get lost. And then finally, it's a way to protect our cultural resources. And you mentioned several good ones there. And we want people to see them, but we know that we can't let them do it unmonitored. We've tried that before with some pictographs in the park, and they were getting vandalized. And so we have to be mindful of what we are tasked with protecting. And our mission is not to make sure people get to see whatever they want, whenever they want it. Our mission is to manage and conserve the natural and cultural resources of Texas. But it's not something we take lightly. It's a conversation we have daily as a leadership team. How can we conserve these, but how can we make sure that there is a way for the public to enjoy them? That's where interpretation comes in. There's a lot of things Kevin and Misty, our park interpreter, talk about that people don't necessarily get to see. But going back to that public use plan, these are conversations we're having. How can we get access to this in a responsible manner where people get the experience, but they do so in a way that is giving integrity and value to the resources that are there?
Well, I know there are a lot of hidden gems back there. I do a lot of reading. Everything's on the internet. There's photos. Sometimes there's even GPS coordinates. You can figure this stuff out if you spend enough time.
Absolutely.
I mean, like all the slot canyons, caves, arches, evidence of Native American habitation, the Veterans Rock. I've been to that one. I know where it is, but I haven't told anybody where it is because it's probably not a good idea, right? Otherwise, they would beat a path back there. So I understand why you don't advertise some of these things. And yet, those are still some of the things that pique the curiosity of folks who, I guess, want to see it all. Right?
Absolutely. And I have a desire to see them, Nick. I haven't been to these places. I mean, that's one of the things that I pride myself in and our staff is we're not taking advantage of things that we're not allowing the public to go see. And so we want to see them just as badly as the public does, and we are committed to working on a way to do that that's responsible.
After the break, we'll talk about the people who come to the canyon, the things they do, and what we can look forward to in the future.
The MBA is the most popular graduate degree in the United States, and with good reason. It leads to better jobs, promotions, and salary increases. At the Paul and Virginia Engler College of Business at West Texas A&M University, our MBA program is entirely online for when you're ready to make that move. With as few as 31 credit hours and specializations offered in 5 areas, you can fast-track your career in as little as 18 months. Whether you're looking for a promotion or initial job placement, you'll stand head and shoulders above the competition. And because we've been teaching online since 1997, we're not the new kids on the block. Trust your education and career to dedicated faculty who are not only experts in their fields, but also old pros in the online arena. Our consistently high rankings say it all. A GMAT waiver is available. We're AACSB accredited and among the most elite of business schools around the world. Reach for the stars and do it with a WT MBA in hand. For more information, find us at wtamu.edu/COB or call 806-651-2500. From the Texas Panhandle to the world, we're here to help you reach those stars.
Even with a wide variety of activities at the Canyon, I suspect there are a few specific things to do that get the majority of visitors' attention. For example, I don't have any doubt that the Lighthouse Trail is the most visited, in spite of the fact that the CCC Trail is right there on the rim by the visitor center. It's the first trail you come to. The Lighthouse is the marquee attraction. Any idea how many people do it?
You know, Nick, we don't have a hard number on that, but we do have some weekend data. So we have a group of volunteers that every weekend in the summer months sets up a cooling station at the trailhead of Lighthouse and passes out water bottles, tries to dissuade visitors from going and hiking in the heat of the day. And they will report, you know, 300, 350, 400 visitors a day on a Saturday and Sunday going on Lighthouse Trail. So I don't have a hard number on that for what that looks like year round, but it is by far the most utilized and most popular trail.
I know there are times when I'm out there hiking just to give my mind something to do. In addition to listen to the podcast I have on, I'm counting people, bikes, dogs and cats. And I haven't found a cat yet. No one's been walking a cat. So that's always zero. But there have been times when I've come back on the White Lighthouse Trail and counted 200 people. And that's just in the span of a few miles.
Absolutely.
That's crazy. I mean, it's like everybody and their brother was out there and they're all doing it. And most of them didn't have any water with them.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, not good. But wasn't this one of the trails carved out by the CCC?
No, actually, the CCC didn't do this. We didn't have access legally to the lighthouse until the 70s.
Oh, my. So
it was part of the Lighthouse Ranch for an extended period of time. People would trespass and go out there, which is never a good idea in Texas. But eventually, we were able to obtain that property in the 70s. And so CCC did a lot of trails, but a lot of the trail work was done later in the 70s by Red Spicer, who was the chief ranger, and then his friends, Given and Lowry, that did our GSL trail that's named for them. So they did a lot of that trail work in the 70s to do that. So CCC did a lot. But they've expanded on that in the 70s. So it's not like we just took the original CCC trails and that's all you get. There's additional work done.
Well, you can definitely tell that a lot of people have done the Lighthouse Trail because there's sections where the trail is actually pounded in about 4 feet deep between the land on both sides. That is a lot of pounding.
It is a lot of pounding. One thing I want to note real quick, if you are doing the Lighthouse Trail now, when you get about the 2.1. If you look to the left-hand side, if you're heading out on the lighthouse, you will see fence posts that are big round posts still on the ground. That was the fence line for the Lighthouse Ranch. So like Kevin was saying, you could get close, but you couldn't get all the way up there.
Do you have to do many rescues on this trail? I mean, I know there's abundant signage about taking proper precautions and all that, but somehow people seem to miss those.
It's funny you mentioned that. We were having this conversation with our law enforcement yesterday. Last year, we responded to 45 calls for rescues involving law enforcement and first responders, which is down. That's actually a very good year for those. 37 out of those 45 calls were on the lighthouse. If we add the number of third-party reports or calls that come in directly to the park, not to 911, or the number of rescues that turn into secondary rescues and then compound from there, that number easily climbs into the hundreds. We, on weekends in the summer, joke that we've got to be by the radio. So don't get on a weed eater. Don't get on a lawnmower. You've got to hear the radio because we're getting called out. And as far as the signage, you make a great point. Not only are there signs all over the Lighthouse Trail, as I mentioned during the summer, we have a volunteer group that is setting up at the trailhead, passing out waters, encouraging people not to go on the trail. And in spite of this, people are people and pride is real. So many people that we rescue make comments like, I thought you were exaggerating how hard this was, or I thought I was in better shape. And what we know is he doesn't discriminate. So while Paladura Canyon is beautiful, we also know that it is deadly. Sadly, the majority of our leadership team and field staff, myself included, have watched somebody pass away on the Lighthouse Trail.
I've noticed the slow but steady erosion. Well, that's basically the story of the canyon, but I've seen it a lot this year because of the rains, and I've seen on the lighthouse that it's slowly getting a little bit harder to get up onto, especially the last point two, from the picnic table straight up, basically. Do you think there will ever be need for repairs or improvements so that people can keep going up there, or are you just going to let nature run its course?
That's a good question, Nick. And Paladura Canyon was formed by erosion, and erosion is still forming it today. One thing to mention on the Lighthouse Trail, and this is where we could use the public's help. One of the reasons the trail itself is in such bad shape is the number of UTV trips we have to take out for rescues. Every time we bring a UTV out, it is just eating away and pounding away at that trail. And unfortunately, on a lot of our rescues, it starts off with one UTV. We send a rescue unit two behind it. And then Canyon Fire and Randall Fire both have their own UTVs that'll have to go out on trail to render aid to our visitors. And so that has been a huge reason as to why that trail's eroding. So again, we ask for the public's help. When you come visit, bring plenty of water. But we do have to address some of those issues. It's hard. We're making a plan right now. You can't get equipment out there, right? So it's not like we can bring a skid steer out there and start leveling that area out. But something is going to have to change. And so we're looking at that. And I do think we're going to have to address the last 0.2 miles, right? Getting up to the actual formation itself. It's dangerous. We did a rescue on that last Sunday to the point that we had to have ropes rescues come out. I'm sorry, it was Sunday before last. And so it's not safe anymore for us to bring a Stokes basket and carry somebody down. We've got to use ropes. And so that involves, you know, adding an additional hour, hour and a half into a rescue operation, setting those up so we can get somebody from the top down. So it's an area that we know needs improvement, and we're working diligently on trying to improve that.
The cat is out of the bag, so to speak. What may once have been a well-kept secret for the masses outside this area is now pretty much common knowledge. Do you ever see the time coming when you have to discourage visitors or, gasp, go to a reservation system like some of the national parks have done?
There are one-offs where we try to discourage visitation, and those are our large signature events like 24 Hours in the Canyon, where access to the majority of the canyon is severely limited due to that event, or even the Paladura Trail Run. With over 700 runners coming in, it can certainly create a bottleneck, cause safety concerns with one road in, one road out, limit our response time to rescues. But besides those one-offs, I don't think there's a time that we're going to be limiting. We do have a cap in place of 999 daily passes sold a day, or 1,000. We often sell into the negatives. Comfortably, if we spread that time out, we can accommodate 1,200, 1,300 people. Before we got to a point where we were going to do reservations, we may try limiting some in the morning, some in the evening, but I think we'd have to see a much larger increase in visitation before we get to that. And again, that's where we're trying to be proactive. With this public utility plan, we're trying to see these issues coming down the pipeline and ensure that we're being responsible and making choices and decisions that'll limit us ever having to make a decision like that.
My guests today have been Zach McMeans, Assistant Superintendent of Paladura Canyon State Park, and Kevin Lane, a volunteer there. With winter coming on, this is an especially good time to get outside and enjoy the beauty we have only minutes away. I might even see you out there. Fade to black, roll credits.
You've been listening to Buff Speak from the Paul and Virginia Engler College of Business at West Texas A&M University. Our executive producer is Justin Lovell, and Allison Hunter is our associate producer. Our co-editors are Maverick Evans and Paul Torres. Lindsay Bjork is our director of marketing and outreach initiatives, which includes overseeing Buff Speak. Dr. Jeffrey Babb is director of accreditation and is our technical consultant. Finally, Dr. Amjad Abdulat is dean of the college. You can find us online at wtamu.edu/COB for more information about our programs. Be sure to check out our many academic offerings. Come for the quality, stay for the small classes, affordable tuition, and friendly, approachable professors. And look online at our faculty blog, profspeak.com, for more insights. You can listen to Buff Speak on your favorite podcast portal, as well as on our website, buffspeak.biz. And if you like what you've been hearing, don't be afraid to share us with your friends, colleagues, and family. Word of mouth has always been the best form of advertising. Until next time, love one another. For the Paul and Virginia Engler College of Business at West Texas A&M University, I am Dr. Nick Gerlich. And as always, go Buffs! Buff Speak.